of last week, and to make quite certain we understand particularly the dates and the times. Remember what had happened, the Jews were back now in Jerusalem. Cyrus the Persian had conquered Babylon and killed Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, Belshazzar. We'll learn all about that when we come into Daniel. And now he'd taken over, the Medes and the Persians were now in control of the empire there. After about 2 years, this was 48 years after the exile. We'll come back to these dates in a minute. 48 years after the exile, when they'd been taken out of, when Jerusalem had been destroyed. 2 years later, Cyrus tells the Jews that they can go back now. Cyrus, remember, was prophesied many years before by Isaiah that he would be the one who would release them, who would give them their freedom. And now he gives them the permission to go back to their own land, those who wanted to. Only a few, less than 50,000, took up the offer. Most of them stopped in the... they were so comfortable, they decided not to go back. Remember, most of them, this time it's 50 years now after the beginning of the exile, so most of them were born actually in the land. They'd never been, travelled back to, they only knew from their parents and from the prophets what it was like. But it had been kept alive in them each time. The prophets had taken tremendous efforts to make certain that they understood who they were, that they were God's people, they were the Jews, and their homeland was back in Judah, and their capital was Jerusalem. They had changed in that 50 years. You had a complete change in them. When they came out in exile, they were a quarrelsome lot. You remember what happened in the fall of Jerusalem? They were arguing and fighting amongst each other. You have false prophets giving lies and everything. But now they were completely changed. It had done the trick. What God said would happen to them, they'd been cleansed now. They'd settled down, and now they were truly back to the people of God. Even though they were so far away from home, they kept everything alive, and they came back to the true worship. Even in the, they set up little meeting places when they were in at Babylonian Empire, and which we later called synagogues, but at the time they were just meeting places. And they were really sincere Jews now. They'd been cleansed of all the evil that had got into them. And now they were back, this lot, in Jerusalem. And Cyrus had given an edict to say what they could do, and he'd given tremendous help. And it's most important, this edict, because we met it later on when Darius came up to the, that they referred back to it. The edict that they would have all the help they needed to rebuild the temple. And now they were back in their own land now, these few. And you remember how, first of all, they had to settle themselves down. They had all their families, they had to get their homes right so they could live in them, because they'd been in Judah. When they came back, remember, it had been almost deserted. Not like Israel further up, where all the foreigners had been brought in. Judah as a whole was virtually deserted. It was God's plan. He didn't want them to come back into a land full of people who were alien. And they came back there, and they had to start their homes again. But very soon, as soon as they got them settled, the first thing they did, we've got to build the temple now, get on with it. You see, they were a changed people now. They wanted to do what God wanted them to do. And they were really alive. And the first thing, they wanted to build the temple. And the first thing they did, do you know what it was? In building the temple? The first thing they did, before they started building the temple, before they did anything, ordering anything. Now, by setting up the sacrifice. The very first thing they did was to set the order of sacrifice in the right place so that they could worship God. They're going to start right. God is going to be the first in my life, they said, each one of them. And they were all together. Notice that. They were all together in it. Mm-hmm. And so they started the building there. And they started getting ready to lay the foundations. Now, some of the people, when they saw this happening, they were a bit disappointed because they remembered the very old ones, remember how the old temple was. They knew it could never be the same. But with the others, a tremendous joy, which drowned out anything any discord or anything. And they were ready to build, they were ready to start now the building the temple. But then problems came. Unfortunately, the people of Israel, the people that had been coming from all the other lands, they had adopted the Jewish religion. And they said, well, look, we've got as much right to build this temple as you are, because we're now Jews. And we want to help you to do it. But the Jews that came back said, no, you can't. The reason being, you see, although they worshipped God, they also worshipped all the other idols. They were a multi-religious people. And the God of Israel was just another God to them, you see. Now, if they had allowed them to help in the building, they'd have had the right then to come in and take part in the worship. And they'd have brought all the things that they've been cleansed off back again. All the idolatrous worship. Mm-hmm. Remember how we turned to two kings and we saw what they were like. Mm-hmm. They were worshipping all kinds of idols. They were even worshipping to Moloch and sacrificing their sons. All this, they'd have brought all this back. So it was quite right. As I said, even today some of the Jews have queried whether they should have allowed them to do this. But you can see why. It would have destroyed them. Now, the one thing about the Jews, after they came back from the captivity, they never again were guilty of worshipping idols. They never again turned into the... They did things that were wrong, but this is the one thing they never did, which had been the curse right the way down through their history. But now they were cleansed of it. So the 50 years had done the job. Now, just a word about this, because most of the textbooks seem to get this wrong on the commentaries. One commentary, quite a good one I read, they said, well, it was only 50 years, because as though God said it was 70 years, he decided in his mercy, as had been so good, he'd allow him to do it in 50 years. But that is wrong. When God prophesies anything, if he says a date, those prophecies stand and nothing will alter them. This is important to understand this now, because we're going to deal with a lot of prophecies later on. The reason is, the 70 years, they had 50 years in exile, but the captivity lasted 70 years. See, for the 20 years before the destruction of Jerusalem, they were not a nation in their own right. They were not a sovereign nation. They were under the power of other people and other nations. First of all, the Egyptians, and then the Babylonians. They only ruled as kind of puppets to them. Remember how we read what happened to some of the kings when they had to do as they were told. If they didn't do, they were taken off in chains, some to Egypt and some to Babylonian. See, they were not in their own right. So for 70 years, they were virtually captive. And that's where you get the 70 years from. Don't let me be confused on that. You'll find a lot of commentaries to get that muddled up. So now they're back, and we've got this problem now with the Samaritans. They've refused to let the Samaritans help them. And then the Samaritans, they got very annoyed about this. So, well, why can't we? We're Jews the same as you. Why can't we help in this? But they insisted they would not let them do it, and this turned them. You're rejecting us, aren't you? And they turned quite nasty. And they did everything in their power to stop them going ahead with the building of the temple. They hired people to go to the king, to Cyrus, in the court there, to give a false report about them. And this, incidentally, carried on for a long time. Now, have you got in the book of Ezra here? Now, that gets you up to chapter 3 and verse 5. Now, from verse 6 up until verse 23 is an insertion there. It's just to show how this antagonism carried on for many, many years. In actual fact, that insertion is looking 70 years ahead, at least 70 years, go right in the future, to show how the antagonism carried on all the time. So don't let that confuse you. That's just an insertion there. The history then carries on. Really, if you take that out, then you can come back down to verse 24. So really, you should read on from verse 4 of chapter 4 and then go on to verse 24. And that's how it goes on. Now then, what had happened here? They had a tremendous amount of opposition from the Samaritans. They did everything in their power to stop them from building the thing. And after a while, the building came to a standstill. There were so many problems, so much. Remember, their supply lines went right back to Lebanon, where they had to get all the timber and everything from there. and they caused so much problems that the actual building of the temple stopped. It was very, very difficult for them. And this went on for a number of years, probably, I'm trying to work it out, probably about, must have been about 12, 15 years. And everything came to a standstill there. But in the meantime, a lot of things had happened. Cyrus, who brought them out, when he was fighting, continually they were in battles on their borders, and he was killed on the eastern front. And then his son took over from him. His son's name was Cambyses. Now, Cambyses, he expanded the empire, and he pushed it right in as far as the river Indus, that's against India, so it included modern Pakistan, and he also attacked into Egypt, and he went right the way through Egypt, right the way down to northern Sudan, what we call modern northern Sudan. It's called Ethiopia in the book, but it's really northern Sudan, and he expanded his empire right the way down there. But before he went down to Egypt, he was a bit worried that his brother might take over from him and might usurp his power. So he, very quietly, he murdered him and tried to keep it quiet. Well, it solved the problem for him then, but it caused a lot of problems later on for a successor. Because when he died, after he died, who was going to succeed after him? And there was quite turmoil throughout the whole nation. And eventually, Darius was the one who claimed the heir, and he was quite a powerful character. And he took over the running of the whole of the empire there. And this is where we come to now, when we came into chapter 4 and verse 24. So the work on the temple had stopped, and this will be up to about 17 years now after they come back, when it had started. So it's been now 17 years, about 17 years, 16 or 17 years. And now Darius is the king. So then we turned over and saw what happened. Incidentally, you look at all this and you can see God's timing in a way. God says 70 years. Mm. If they'd have gone and built immediately, there were 17 years wouldn't have been. This is the building of the temple this time. I'll come back to that in a minute. Anyway, so now Darius is the king. And then we got, I referred to in Haggai, how God spoke through the prophets. You had Haggai and Zechariah now are the two prophets. They're teaching the people and speaking to them. And then God stirred up Haggai and told him, now is the time, look, I want you to get them to start building the temple. He said, look at you. And Haggai prophesied to them and said to them, God has said, look, you're all in your nice houses and everything. You've got everything you want there, but look at my house. And you look around and see what God is trying to tell you. Your crops are failing and all these things are happening to you. You're not as you should be. The reason for that is because you're not putting God first. You're not building his temple. Then we read in Haggai, let's just have a quick look at that to remind you, because I think it's quite beautiful. The voice of the Lord their God and the message of prophet Haggai, I'm chapter 1 now, in verse 12 of Haggai. Because the Lord your God had sent him, and the people feared the Lord. You see the effect that the prophet had upon them, speaking the word of God. Then Haggai, the Lord's messenger, gave this message of the Lord to the people. I am with you, declared the Lord. So the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, son of the high priest, and the spirit of the whole remnant of the people. They came and began work on the house of the Lord Almighty, their God, on the 24th day of the sixth month in the second year of King Darius. The time was right now. God had stirred them up, and they all decided, we're going to build the house. But there's a problem, you see. In that first 2 years of Darius' reign, he'd had a lot of problems trying to assert himself. There had been rebellions throughout the empire, and so it had been very, very difficult. And they were on the look all the time to see whether anything would happen, to keep an eye on everybody. And when they started rebuilding the temple, it came to the notice of the governors there what they were doing. Probably the Samaritans probably put them up to it. And they said, well, what's happening here? Look, they're moving great big stones here. It can't be just for a temple, all these great big stones they're putting in there. Perhaps they're going to revolt. They're going to build up fortresses and everything. And so they sent people to question them, and they asked them, why are you doing this? What authority have you got to do this? And they said, well, we had the authority from Cyrus. He told us we could do this. And it's in an edict. He made an edict about this, that we could do this. And then they explained exactly what. Now, the people came, they took the names of everybody. It was quite a tricky situation, this, because they could be held responsible, all these people. But he says the eye of God was on them all the time. It was God's plan now, you see. He was looking over them. And what happened was, they didn't stop them from building. They said, well, if it's Cyrus, Egypt, we didn't stop in case it's right. But they sent a message to Darius the king and told him all what was happening. So Darius said, right, we'll search and find out whether this is true or not. So first of all, they searched in Babylon, but they couldn't find anything in the records. And they said, oh, one minute. Perhaps it's, remember Cyrus came from Medo-Persia, perhaps it's where he was there. And so they went and searched there, and there they found it. Wonderful how God did this, isn't it? After all these, and all the turmoil, the records were still there. See, God had made provision for this. And they read through it, and they said, yes, it's correct. Cyrus had made this edict. Remember, the law of the Medo-Persians, it can't be altered, it's the law. So they must do it. And then Darius went even further than that. He decided, he said, right, I'm going to give them even more power. So he made an edict himself, which said that they're to have everything they need to build this temple. You have all the help they want, and you give a strict warning, anybody who stops them, they're going to be severely dealt with. And you see how God was working at the right time here. So now they had the authority to build the temple. And so they immediately set work to it. And remember how it was very quickly done, because they had all the help they needed now, money and everything. Because Darius, the idea, Darius probably was thinking, well, perhaps if I do this, the God of Israel will bless me and my sons. But that's one way of looking at it. But the other way of looking at it, we know that it was God's hand moving. He was moving. Now watch this, how he moves. This is what I tried to get over last week. Cyrus, how he raised him up. And now how he raised Darius up. And we're going to see this all the way through. God is in complete control. And we're going to see this with Esther when we go through there. As he's in control of the people then, so he's in control of all the nations. See how he was moving these nations.
Yeah.
God is in complete control. We look at the world around us. God is in control of all these nations. God is not just sitting at the sideline, watching and then coming in now again. He's in absolute control. And as he's in control of the nations, he's in control of our lives as well. If you look back on your life, this is a lesson to learn from this. God is in complete control. Now then, just a point on this, on dates. Now this is the end. Remember, it was 20 years after their return from exile. Jerusalem was destroyed 50 years before that. Mm-hmm. So it's 70 years now. So you've got two dots of 70 here. It can get rather confusing, this. All right, let's go through it again. First of all, you had the 70 years of captivity, which was started 20 years before the fall of Jerusalem, when they were really captive under first the Egyptians and then the Babylonians. They ruled, it was not a sovereign nation. Captivity means they were ruled by permission of other people. But that was 20 years before the fall of Jerusalem. And then that ended when they returned by Cyrus 50 years after the captivity. That's the first 70 years. But now the desolation of the temple started when the temple was destroyed at the time when Babylon was destroyed. And that carried on 50 years of the captivity, and then 20 years it took to rebuild the temple. Have you got that now? So you've got another 70 years. So there's 70 years of captivity, which started 20 years before the destruction of Jerusalem. The 70 years of the desolation of the temple, which started when the temple was destroyed until it was rebuilt. So it's 70 years altogether. Two sets of 70 years, you see. The people get very confused on there. They get the two muddled up. We're going to refer back to these when we come to Daniel. That's why I want to put a great deal of stress on them now. The temple now has been completed, and a great rejoicing there. And that is where we ended up in chapter 6 there. Now, between chapter 6 and chapter 7, at that point there, there's a period of 58 years. We'd round it up, we call it 60, but we'd say there is actually, it was between, there's a big gap of 58 years there. And it starts up again at that point there. And a great deal happened in that time there, which is the silent years as far as Ezra, as far as the scripture was concerned, except we've got record in Esther. That's why I'm going to turn to Esther at this time here. Now, what had happened, briefly, after Darius died, then we have Xerxes became the emperor of the land, the king of the land. And it was a mighty empire he'd inherited. It stretched from right down beyond Egypt into Sudan, right the way through to beyond modern Pakistan, right to the River Indus on the border of India. It was a massive empire. He had a wonderful, a powerful empire. And that's the situation that we're in at this point. Now, we're talking about Xerxes at the moment now. Oh, yes, that's another. See, one is the Greek. And the other is the Persian. That's why the Xerxes is the Greek translation.
And the same with Darius the First.
That's right.
Aristeppes.
That's it. Yes, there's two different translations. Mm-hmm. You know, they call them. You sometimes meet them called one thing, and sometimes the other thing. Right. So now, in this period here of this 58 years of silence, we have the book of Esther comes in here. This is where it comes in. This is why I want to fit it in here. Because it lays the foundation for the rest of Ezra. And we can understand then why Ezra and Nehemiah and that were treated so well by their captives and were so much looked after from this period. So remember, there's a 58 years gap between chapter 6 and chapter 7. Right, now let's turn on to the book of Esther now. Now in the book of Esther, the event recorded here opens in the third year of King Xerxes' reign, about 483 BC. The temple had been completed in 516, that's about 33 years previously. So you've got a gap of about 33 years, you see, which ended the first section of Ezra at the end of chapter 6. So all these events took place in the 58 years or so of silence between chapter 6 and chapter 7 of Ezra. Xerxes was the son of Darius the First, whose decree had enabled the temple to be completed in God's time, 70 years, exactly on God's time, after the destruction of the first temple. Xerxes has inherited from his father a vast empire which stretched from modern Pakistan in the east to beyond Egypt in the west, right down into what's modern Sudan, actually. When Cyrus had allowed the return of the Jews to Judea, only a relatively few had availed themselves of the opportunity. And now, some 60 years later, large numbers of Jews remained in the eastern half of the Persian Empire. Very little is known of these except from the Book of Esther. Despite hostility due to their determination to observe their own laws and customs, they remained true Jews and God's people. Some of the Jews, they rose to positions of influence, and we'll learn all about those later. In the past, there was some doubt, both by Jews and Christians, as to whether the Book of Esther should be included in the canon of Scripture, i.e. whether it was God-inspired or not. But from internal evidence of it, and the comparison with history and conditions of the period, it has been accepted now by both Jews and Christians. There was a little bit of doubt, but it was obvious, in reading through it, as you compared, that this was a true account. One of the chief objections to its authenticity as God's word was there's no reference to God in it. God is not mentioned anywhere in the book. But in fact, God's name is given by a remarkable veiled form. Now, the name for God in Hebrew is the letters YHVH, which stands for Yahweh or Jehovah. And it occurs in the narrative four times in an acrostic form at critical points in the story. Now, this couldn't possibly be by chance and would be extremely difficult to do by design. You see, that's why I gave you this here. This explains it here, what an acrostic is. It's the, as you write, you get the first letters in the words as they follow. They would spell out something, a name or something like that. Now, it looks simple, but to try and do this and to get the story running properly is extremely difficult. And it's not only done once, it's done four times. And to make it even more fantastic, it's done at a particular time, a critical point in the story. Every time we come to a critical point in the story, we get this acrostic in there. Twice it's done forwards, and twice it's done backwards. Now, if you try and do an acrostic, you'll find how difficult it is. And this is what we call the stamp of God on it. It's as though God is veiled behind here. He's hidden, but he's there. It's God's stamp on Esther to show you that this is his work. And we'll see all the way through it as we follow the story. We'll see, you can almost see God in the background. He's controlling everything. Although he's not named, you can see every step. You can see how his hand is upon them. And I think it's fantastic, this. Incidentally, this about the acrostic, you'll find all the concordances, they all miss this. It's strange, really. I've only found one that gave it. But all of them, for some reason, they don't get it. Now, the Book of Esther is greatly valued nowadays by Orthodox Jews who have suffered so much through the ages and have clung to the assurance that however severe the threat upon their race, God will always uphold his people. Despite all adversity, they have a future. So they can see how at times they were going to be wiped out, but God was in control. And they look back at this, and I'm going to talk about this later on when we talk about the feast, which is celebrated every year, a month before Passover. They have a feast, a celebration to remember this. Right, Esther chapter 1, verses 1 to 9. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes, who ruled over 127 provinces, stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials, the military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the province were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed gardens of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, festooned with cords of white linen and purple material, to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant, in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of the king Xerxes. Now, the narrative opens and conveys in just a few words the vastness of the empire of which Xerxes was the supreme ruler. In the third year of his reign, he had now settled the empire. There had been some problems, you see, but now he'd got it all sorted out. And during that time, he'd also rebuilt the city of Susa. And now he had a strongly fortified palace in the middle of the city, and in the complex of the city there. And now he's going to celebrate all this by giving a huge banquet for all the leaders and important people of his empire. Previous to the banquet, he had made a display of all his vast wealth and splendour to them. Imagine all these things, all this gold and everything. He was the ruler of the greatest kingdom, well, the one great kingdom of the world there. He had everything there.
This would have been in Persia.
Yes, this is in Persia. Susa. Yeah. All these people were now at the banquet able to example the immense luxury and splendour of the kings. Well, it says the normal people, it wouldn't be the common people, it would all the least of all the rulers and all the all his officials from the whole empire. He called them all together for this great banquet. They were allowed to drink freely as much wine as they wanted, and they were served in individually designed solid gold goblets. Yeah, beautiful, wouldn't it be? The queen in her own royal apartments gave a banquet for the woman. So he was showing what a wealthy king what he was. He got everything, all this vast wealth. He ruled this mighty nation here. And he was the one, the head of everything, with supreme power of life and death over everybody. Now verse 10. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him, Mehuamin, Bizpathar, Harbonir, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zetha, and Carcas, to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people, and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. Oh dear. The great king who ruled over all the known world and enjoyed unlimited resources and prestige was never left vulnerable. This incident raised the question as to who had the last word at home. After a week of celebration and liberal drinking, the king must have been full of high spirits, and to some extent he was intoxicated. He regarded Vashti, his queen, as his most precious possession, and he wanted to show off her beauty to everyone as a climax to the great exhibition. Her impertinence in refusing to appear so humiliated the king before all the people, the leaders of his kingdom, was a very dangerous thing to do. Now, some people have tried to put in here and said, well, perhaps he wanted her to appear naked or something like that, but that's nonsense. It wouldn't occur in this at all. He just wanted to show the people in all her beauty with a crown and everything on. Remember, the king had the power of life and death over all his subjects, and now his wife was openly flouting his authority in front of everyone. Her reason for doing this is not stated, and this adds to the tension of the situation. The king was absolutely furious with her for showing him up in front of all the people. Why she did this, we just don't know. Perhaps you thought, well, I'm not going to do as I'm told here. I'm the queen. It may be that. We don't know. It's left for her own conjecture. It'd be dangerous to try and make up, what the reason would be. Verses 13 to 16. The king, even in his intoxicated state, has the sense to consult his advisers and wise men as to what to do. So you'll read that in 13 to 16. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of law and justice, he spoke to the wise men who understood the laws and were closest to the king: Karshina, Shetha, Admatha, Tarshish, Mears, Marcina, Memucan, and seven nobles of Persia and Media, who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. According to the law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? He asked. She has not obeyed the command of the king Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. Then Memucan replied, in the presence of the king and the nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands, and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought to him, but she wouldn't come. This very day, the Persian and Median woman of the nobilities, who've heard about the Queen's conduct, will respond to all the King's nobles in this same way. There'll be no end of disrespect and discord. See, they very cleverly point out to him that if he allows her to get away with it, it would set an example for all the wives of the men in the kingdom, and the result could be disastrous. They said, as she despised you, so will all the wives in the kingdom despise their husbands, causing no end of discord and trouble. The big mistake that Vashti made was that though in private she probably ruled the roost, had a great deal of influence over the king, she must never allow a hint of this to be shown in public, because he was a great king, and he must never let it, because it would bring him down, you see. Now the situation, in some ways, is very comical, even when not so serious. So let's see what happens. The king, at the beginning of the chapter, is depicted as the world's greatest king. Well, let's see how it works out here. Therefore, in verse 19, therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, notice that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also let the king give a royal position to someone else, who is better than she. Then when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands, from the least to the greatest. The king and his nobles were pleased with this advice, so the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, and to each people in its own language, proclaiming in each people's tongue that every man should be ruler over his own household. Oh dear. Mm. See, at the beginning, we had explained what a powerful and mighty king he was. Had all power, but now at the end of chapter he's desperately trying to maintain his dignity in front of all these people, despite the defiance of his wife. The counsellors may have been very clever, but they weren't very wise. The decree he made on their advice made the king look a fool in the eyes of his subjects, and from chapter 2 we read he probably regretted banishing Vashti when his mind was so fuddled with wine. For him to make such an edict, which according to the Persians could not be altered, he was seen, he was not quite sober when he did it, was not a good example. He was the lawmaker, and look what a stupid thing he'd done. And people would say, well, fancy doing that. He's our lawmaker who makes all our laws. So it wasn't a very good idea for at all. So that's how we end up in the chapter there. Now, chapter 2. Later, when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. Then the king's personal attendants proposed, let a search to be made for a beautiful young virgin to the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful girls into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the girl who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. When the king sobered up and was thinking straight, he realized what he'd done. But he was trapped by his own edict, which by the law of the Medes and Persians couldn't be altered. That was their strict law. When an edict was made, nobody could order, not even the king. The servants who waited on the king, realizing the fix he was in, and so they urged him to take up Memucan's suggestion to find someone else to replace Vashti, to which the king agreed, and so the search begins. Verse 5. Now there was in the city of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into the exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. among those taken captive with Jehoiakim, king of Judah. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. The girl, who was also known as Esther, was lovely in form and features, and Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. Now here we're introduced to Mordecai and his beautiful cousin, whom he looked after when her parents had died. Now, although it appears to say that Mordecai had been captured by Nebuchadnezzar, this couldn't be like that. What it's really inferring is that either his father or grandfather, because if he'd been taken captive, he'd have been much too old by now. Don't know what age he'd been, approaching about 90s or 100, and so would his cousin. So that's what it probably means there. It gets a little bit confusing at that point. Verse 8 to 11. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many girls were brought to the city of Susa and put under the care of Haggai. Esther also was taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Haggai, who had charge of the harem. The girl pleased him and won his favour. Immediately he had provided with her beauty of treatment and special food. He assigned to her 7 maids selected from the king's palace and moved her and her maids into the best place in the harem. Esther had not yet revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Every day he walked to and fro near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. We're not told how she was selected, but she doesn't give any indication of being forced or unwilling right from the start. So she was selected by Haggai as the favourite. But by not saying anything about her background, her Jewish, she showed her discretion and she had good sense and tact, you see. She didn't want to reveal this at that time then. Verse 12. And notice how her cousin was keeping an eye on her. He wouldn't have any contact with her. They weren't allowed to. But he would have contact with people, you know, in the palace. And they were keeping contact and telling, you know, how she was getting on. Verse 12. Before a girl's turn came to go to the king Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women, 6 months with oil and myrrh, and 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. And this is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go there, and in the morning return to another part of the harem, to the care of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her, and summoned her by name. When the turn came for Esther, the girl Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of his uncle Abelihar, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Haggai, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favour of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month, and the month of Tebeth in the 7th year of his reign. Now in here we see what a nice sensible character she was. She was not only very beautiful, but she was a very nice person who quickly won the favour of everybody. Notice, she didn't ask the other girls. You see, what would happen? They become concubines, and virtually they would never be, they'd be just kept in the harem for the rest of their lives. And they thought, oh, well, we'll get most we can out of this. And so they were given anything that they want, and they'd probably ask for all kinds of things. But Esther didn't do that at all. She just said, well, what should I take with me? What should I have? She wasn't a grasping. She wasn't there for the grasping. She wasn't a gold digger. That was the idea. And it just shows what a lovely character this girl was. She was a beautiful woman. Verses 17 to 18. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than any of the other women, and she won his favour and approved more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his nobles and officials. He proclaimed a holiday throughout the province and distributed gifts with royal liberality. The outcome was almost predictable. The king was immediately attracted to her. and immediately made her his queen in place of Vashti. And he held a great, there was great rejoicing throughout the whole kingdom. They all had a holiday throughout the whole kingdom, but certainly throughout the city, and treated it as a great time of rejoicing here. So now, she is now the queen. And now verses 19 onwards. When the virgins were assembled a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, but Esther had kept secret her family background and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her to do, for she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions, as she had done when he was bringing her up. During the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were hanged on the gallows. And all this was recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king. Now, what had happened here, it appears that Esther had used her influence to get her cousin a position as a judge or a magistrate who used to sit at the gate and judge the people. So got him elevated up to this position here. And it was while he was in this position at the gate, he would hear all kinds of things that were going on. Now these two men, they'd been appointed to look after the king and his safety. And their lives were at stake if anything happened to the king. They were under oath to protect the king at all costs. But for some reason they got annoyed with the king, and these who had access to the king, they were going to kill the king, like this, you see. It was a very dangerous situation. And when Mordecai told Esther about it, he got the message to Esther, he wouldn't be able to speak to her, then she got it to the king. And the king immediately investigated this, and when he found out it was true, probably under torture or some way, you got the truth out of them, he had them hung on gallows. But notice how Esther made certain that Mordecai had the the king knew it was all about, Mordecai had done this, and that was entered in the annals and now the record. Now this is very important, because this comes up later, you see. We'll see how this comes up, this incident here. And in a way you can see, if you're looking around, you can see how God's moving. Look, every step, we can't see him, he's not mentioned at all, but you see every step we're going to see how God is in control of everything. Now we go on to chapter 3 now. After the events, King Xerxes honoured Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agite, and elevating him and giving him a seat of honour, higher than that of all the other nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honour to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honour. Then the royal officials of the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore they told Haman about it, to see whether Mordecai's behaviour would be tolerated, for he told them he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honour, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of just killing Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, through the whole kingdom of Xerxes. Haman was now promoted to a position second only to the king, and as custom demanded, everybody would be expected to bow down before him. For some reason, we don't know why, Mordecai refused to do this. He probably, for some reason, despised him. He was not a very nice character at all, and Mordecai said, "I'm not going to bow down to worship it, do it before him." It's interesting to note in verse 2, the king had to order people to do this. They would do it naturally, normally, but the king had to send out an order. So there's something about Haman. We'll see this later as it comes out. So Mordecai wasn't going to be a hypocrite. He wasn't going to do this. Now, the place where Mordecai did the judging, it was a huge area. It wasn't a tiny little gate. It was a huge courtyard, an immense place, and nobody would probably notice him. Haman would probably notice him at all as he came through. But it was only when somebody came up and said to him, "Why isn't Mordecai bowing down? When you go by there, we look and he's not bowing down." And they said, "Is there some reason? Is he something special or something?" And that's when it was brought to Haman's notice. And Haman was furious when he found this. "Oh, I'm not having this. What, who do you think he is?" But then he found out he was a Jew. I'll not only get rid of him, I'll get rid of all these people as well. Perhaps they're just as bad as him. Perhaps they'll give me trouble as well. I'll get rid of all the Jews. You can see how his mind was working there. Now verse 7. In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, they cast the pur, that is the lot. Now we're going to come back to this later. In the presence of Haman, to select a day, and the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. He bided his time. He wasn't going to do it. He was going to make certain he's going to do this properly. He could have done immediately. "Oh, for now, I'm going to make certain I get this done properly." And he said, "Well, first of all, I'm going to select a date." And that's the chart. What they used to do there, they used to throw lots to, in their superstitious mind, to pick a date which they thought would be lucky when he could go and see the king and get this done. And that's what they're doing. It's called the pur, which we're coming back to. We'll see where this comes in. And also the date as well is very important. This superstition believed that he would be lucky on that day when he acted. Now verses 8 to 9. Now follow this carefully. Then Haman said to King Xerxes, "There's a certain people dispersed and scattered among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of all the other people. They do not obey the king's laws. It's not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury for the men who carry out this business." Incidentally, 10,000 was an enormous sum of money. It was almost it's kind of a bribe in a sense, this was. Now follow what he'd done here. He'd very cunningly pretended to the king that this alien race were a threat to him. He uses a cunning mixture of truths, half-truths, and outright lies to convince the king. You see what it was? It was true that the Jews had their own laws, but it wasn't true that they didn't obey the king's laws. They still obeyed the king's laws, as well as their own laws. You see how he twisted it to make it look like this? This is quite important because it's the same with Christians, you know. People have turned round to us and say, "You know, you're not obeying the laws." We do obey the laws of the land. We're told to obey the laws of the land. But we also obey the Lord, God's laws. Mm-hmm. We don't lie, we don't cheat. You see how it can apply to us, the same thing. Mm-hmm. They were perfectly innocent. But it had been twisted in such a way that he thought that this would be like that. Right, verses 10 to 15. So the king took the signet ring of his finger and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedata the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. "Keep the money," the king said to Haman, "and do with the people as you please." Then on the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretaries were summoned. They wrote out in the script of each province and the language of each people all Haman's orders to the king's satraps, the governors of the various provinces, and the nobles of the various peoples. These were written in the name of Xerxes himself and sealed with his own ring. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and little children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, to plunder their goods. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality, so it would be ready for that day. Spurred on by the king's command, the couriers went out, and the edict was issued in the city of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered. Believing what Haman had said, and without checking the full truth of it, the king issues this disastrous decree. which, remember, could not be altered. When the king issued a decree, nothing could alter it. The king can't alter it, nobody can alter it. The king was presuming, was thinking that the people involved were just distant aliens who were hostile to him. And he handed over the full authority to Haman, the ring, you see, to do what he wanted with them. You see, he was a bit gullible, the king, in a sense. Easily led. Now, he should have checked out what it was all about. And this was going to be disastrous. Right, chapter 4. When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter in. In every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay on sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent in clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he wouldn't accept them. Then Esther summoned Hathor, one of the king's eunuchs, assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what's troubling Mordecai and why. So Hathor went out to Mordecai in the open square in the city, in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show Esther and explain to her, and he told him to urge her to go into the king's presence to beg for mercy and plead with him for the people. Hathor went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, "All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned to the king has but one law, that he should be put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the gold scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king." When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer: "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise, now notice this, from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to the royal position for such a time as this?" Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai: "Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa, and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it's against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. When the edict was made known, immediately Mordecai and all the Jews started mourning, and most revealing, fasting. You don't fast unless you pray. See, they were praying. Although it's not mentioned here, they would be praying, you see. This indicates that they were praying, calling upon God to help them. Mordecai now sends a message to Esther. See, at first Esther would have thought, what's wrong with Mordecai? Perhaps there's been some personal tragedy in his life. So that's why she sent the clothes to him. But of course he wouldn't take them, because it was something far more serious than that. Mordecai now sends a message to Esther, asking her to intercede for them before the king. He tells her that in effect God has placed her in that position as queen for this purpose. But if she refuses to help them, God will raise up some other means. This, God always does this. If somebody fails him, he raises up somebody else of saving them. But her father's house will perish. Esther tells him she'll go to the king as requested, but it could well be fatal. But nevertheless, she will still go. She'll still do it. But they must all, like her, fast, which would include praying to God for 3 days and nights. She then is really saying, my life belongs to God. Let his will be done, whether I live or whether I die. I will obey, I will do what I know is right before God. See what a beautiful person she was. Right, chapter 5. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall, facing the entrance. When he saw the queen Esther stand in the court, he was pleased with her and held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter to show she'd been accepted, you see. Now, these two verses hardly do justice what really happened there. We can imagine Vashti goes, she would be extremely nervous there, going and standing before the king. Her life was at stake here. The king could immediately have ordered her put to death, as he would anybody else who'd have done this without. It must have been a tremendous relief to her when the king, you can imagine her putting the scepter out to her like that there. He went, oh, praise the Lord, you know, we'd say it. So she was allowed to approach him. Just imagine what was going on in her mind and her heart at the time here. It gives you an idea what she was like. Then the king asked, what is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom would be given to you. If it pleases the king, replied Esther, let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I have prepared for them. Bring Haman at once, the king said, so he may do what Esther asks. Mm. So the king and Haman went to the banquet Esther had prepared. As they were drinking wine, the king again asked Esther, now what is your petition? It will be given to you, and what is your request? Up to half the kingdom it will be granted. Esther replied, my petition and my request is this. If the king regards me with favour, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfil my request, let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet. I will prepare for them. Then I will answer the king's question. What follows here now, it almost seems like an anti-climax, but it was correct protocol, the correct thing to do, you see. She was following the correct customs. She wouldn't be expected to discuss with the king what must be a very serious matter in front of all the state officials. It was a daring move to include Haman, but as the king's second in command, it wouldn't arise any suspicion. Oh, well, perhaps it's something involved in him, you see. Right, verses 9. Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate, and he observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. Calling together his friends and Zeresh his wife, Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honoured him, and how he had elevated him above all the nobles and fishers. And that's not all, Haman added. I'm the only person Queen Esther has invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave, and she's invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew, Mordecai, sitting at the king's gate. His wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, have a gallows built 75 feet high, and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go with the king to the dinner and be happy. This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the gallows built. Oh, he gives you some insight as to the nature of this man Haman here, boasting about all these things here. He was on top of the world at the unexpected honour, and he left the palace in great spirits. But when he got to the king's gate, this was all checked when he saw Mordecai, who refused to bow down to him. Even though he'd already plotted the destruction of the Jews, he was so infuriated with Mordecai, he wanted to deal with him straight away. So he had these huge gallows constructed and was determined to ask the king in the morning so that Mordecai could be hung on them. You can see how his mind was working. Yeah. Ah, now let's see what happens. Chapter 6. That night the king could not sleep. So he ordered the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. It was found recorded that Mordecai had exposed Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. "What honour and recognition has Mordecai received for this?" the king asked. "Nothing has been done for him," his attendants answered. Now we see God behind the scenes here. Can you see it?
Yeah.
We now again see God's unseen hand at work with the desire of the king to read the records because he couldn't sleep. When he found out that Mordecai's action in saving his life had not been rewarded, he was shocked and decided he'd got to do something about it. It's lovely to see how this is working out. Can you see God in control of everything? Right, verse 4 to 18. The king said, "Who's in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak with the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows he had erected for him. His attendants answered, "Haman is standing in the court." "Bring him in," the king ordered. When Haman entered, the king asked him, "What should be done for the man the king delights to honour?" Now Haman thought to himself, "Who is there that the king would rather honour than me?" So he answered the king, "For the man the king delights to honour, have him bring a royal robe the king has worn, and a horse the king has ridden on, one with royal crest placed on his hand. Then let the robe and horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man the king delights to honour, and lead him on his horse through the city gate, proclaiming before him, 'This is what is done for the man the king delights to honour.'" You can just imagine him thinking, "Oh, look, this is what I'm going to have done to me." "Go at once," the king commanded Haman. "Get the robe and the horse and do just as you suggested for Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Do not neglect anything you have recommended." So Haman got the robe and the horse. He rode Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city streets, proclaiming before him, "This is what's done for the man the king delights to honour." Afterwards, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman rushed home with his head covered in grief and told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had happened to him. His advisers and his wife Zeresh said to him, "Since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin." While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman away to the banquet of Esther and prepared. So you can just imagine the situation there, can't you? Before the king had an audience, they had to all queue up before he was ready, you see, in time. And Haman, being the chief, he was the first one. "I'm going in there. I'm going to ask the king to have Mordecai executed." And then he went in there, and then he forgot all about this for a minute when the king asked him, said, "Well, what am I going to do to honour the man? Oh, what are you going to do for me?" He must have thought it was himself, you see. And then when the king, you can imagine him. But then when the king said, "Go and do that to Mordecai," you can just imagine the situation.
Like a good plot for a movie,
yeah. It'd be lovely to put on a cinema, wouldn't it?
Irony.
You imagine him going into his wife and telling him, "Oh dear, what's happened?" And his wife saying, "Well, look, this, you've got no hope now. This is what's going to happen." And they probably stopped there for some time arguing about it. And remember, he was due at the banquet, and the eunuchs came on to him because he was nervous to go. He said, "Come on, you've got to come quickly." He didn't really want to go. What was going to happen? So now we come to chapter 7 now. Haman realises he chipped her up. Verses 1 and 2. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther. And as they were drinking wine on the second day, the king asked, "Queen Esther, what is your petition? It will be given you whatever it is. What are your requests? Even up to half the kingdom will be granted." It wouldn't really mean half the queen. It's just a way of saying things. "No, I'll give you anything you want, more or less." The king was intrigued to know. He'd been kept on tendering. "What is this you want, sir? What was the important petition that Esther wants to ask of him?" You can imagine the all agog waiting for this. But you imagine poor old Mordecai there, wondering what was going to happen now. Verse 3, then Queen Esther answered, If I have found favour with you, O King, and if it pleases your majesty, grant me my life. This is my petition, and spare my people. This is my request, for I and my people have been sold for destruction and slaughter and annihilation. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet, because no such distress would justify disturbing the king. King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, who is this? Where's the man who has dared to do such a thing? Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this vile Haman. Then Haman was terrified before the king and queen. The king got up in a rage, left his wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman, realizing that the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. Just as the king returned from the palace gardens to the banqueting hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. The king exclaimed, will he even molest the queen while he in the house? As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs attending the king, said, a gallows 75 feet high stand by Haman's house. He had it made for Mordecai, who spoke up to help the king. The king said, hang him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's fury subsided. Oh, wouldn't it have made a lovely movie, this? When she told the king what had happened, Haman was petrified. There was no way he would realise that she was a Jew, you see. She hadn't realised this. And to have the full force of what had happened, he'd done, now becomes home to him. In effect, it showed that Haman was not only a traitor to the king, he wanted to kill the one who'd saved the king's life, you see, Mordecai, but was also actually threatening the queen's life. In his terror, instead of leaving when the king left, which would have been the correct thing to do, he would never stop with the queen by herself in there, he did the unthinkable and stayed alone with the queen, and in a last desperate attempt to beg the queen, I mean, it's really funny in a way, he fell on the couch before her, pleading with her. And of course, when the king saw that, he'll come, get him out, have him hanged. Oh, it's fantastic how it works, really, isn't it? It's so dramatic, all this. Right, now into chapter 8. The same day, King Xerxes gave Queen Esther the estate of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came into the presence of the king, for Esther had told him how he was related to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he had reclaimed from Haman, and presented to Mordecai, and Esther appointed him over Haman's estate. The property of a condemned criminal was always seized by the crown if they were sentenced to death. That was the law in those days. The king now bestows the whole of Haman's estate onto Esther because of all she'd been through, to some form of recompense. And then she appoints Mordecai, because you've got to have someone to look after it, she appoints Mordecai to look after this vast estate and all this wealth. So you see what's happened now. The positions were completely reversed. He was now the one who had been, should have been hung, that Haman wanted to hang. He had gone round the other way. Haman himself was hung. But now all the wealth of Haman had gone to Mordecai. It's beautiful to see the reverse of everything, how it works. Now verses 4 to 8. Oh, by the way, now he's got the signet ring. See what position Mordecai is in. He's not only been reversed, he's also got the position that Haman had. He's second only to the king now. He's got the ring of authority. He's got the power now. Verse 3 now. Esther again pleaded with the king, falling at his feet and weeping. She begged him to put an end to the evil plan of Haman the Agagite, which he had devised against the Jews. Then the king extended the golden scepter to Esther, and she arose and stood before him. If it pleases the king, she said, and if he regards me with favour and thinks it's the right thing to do, and if he's pleased with me, let an order be written overruling the dispatches that Haman, son of Hammedatheth the Agagite, devised and wrote to destroy the Jews in all the king's provinces. For how can I bear to see disaster fallen my people? How can I bear to see the destruction of my family? King Xerxes replied to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, because Haman attacked the Jews, I have given his estate to Esther, and they have hanged him on the gallows. Now write another decree in the king's name on behalf of the Jews, as seems best to you, and seal it with the king's signet ring, for no document written in the king's name and sealed with the ring can be revoked. Now you can see the problem they've got now. This edict that had been sent out could not be revoked. There was no way they could revoke it. It had to go through. So what the king has said, well, look, Haman, I want you to write another edict which will in effect cancel that out. But the edict's got to stand, but you write your edict in such a way, I'll leave it to you, you're a clever Jew, to work this out, how to do it, in such a way that it won't have the effect that Haman wanted it to, and the people won't be destroyed. And so this is what they did. So really, he had to somehow or other nullify it. So verse 9, so that's what he did. At once, the royal secretaries were summoned on the 23rd of the third month, the month of Sivan. They read out all Mordecai's orders to the Jews and to the satraps, governors and nobles, and the 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. These orders were written in the script of each province and the language of each people, and also to the Jews in their own script and language. Mordecai wrote in the name of King Xerxes, sealed the dispatches with the king's signet ring, and sent them by mounted couriers, who rode fast horses especially bred for the king. The king's edict granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate any armed forces of any nationality or province that might attack them and their women and children, and to plunder the property of their enemies. The day appointed for the Jews to do this in all the provinces of King Xerxes was, and note this, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality, so the Jews will be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers, riding the royal horses, raced out, spurred on by the king's command, and the edict was also issued in the city of Susa. The decree now gives the Jews the right to arm themselves, to gather themselves together and attack. See, normally they wouldn't be allowed to arm themselves, but now they had the right to arm themselves and to defend themselves against anyone going to attack them. The decree was sent by messengers on swift horses throughout the empire. But unlike Haman's decree, which was just the language, it made a special point that this decree also went to the Jews. So everybody would know, and the Jews, all the Jews would know. But in Haman's decrees, they'd only heard from the others. They hadn't heard in the Jewish language. It wasn't written in Hebrew, you see. Now, verses 15 to 17. Mordecai then left the king's presence, wearing royal garments of blue and white, a large crown of gold and a purple robe of fine linen. And the city of Susa held a joyous celebration. For the Jews, it was a time of happiness and joy, gladness and honour. In every province, every city, wherever the edict of the king went, there was joy and gladness among the Jews with feasting and celebration. And many people of other nationalities became Jews because of the fear the Jews had seized them. From verse 1, it's clear that Mordecai was a very popular choice as chief minister with all the people. The old people of Susa, they celebrated, you see. Remember before, they were all bemused, they were all confused. Why Mordecai? He was a judge, and they knew that where are the other judges, they could be bribed, but Mordecai couldn't. He was an honest man, and they had tremendous respect for him. That's not the Jews, the other people, you see. And when they heard what had happened, they were overjoyed about all this. It's lovely to see the joy and celebration among all the Jews, now that the terrible possibility of extermination had been removed. Notice also how many people of other nationalities wanted to become Jews, because it was obvious that their God was seen to be all powerful and in complete control of everything. See, the witness they gave, and I've got a note here, shouldn't that be of the Christians? Do people, well, look, God, how God do it. Look at the kind of people they are. They're honest, they're true, and look how this God looks after them and serves them. And that should be an attraction for others. But is it? That's what kind of witness we should be.